Okay. Last time we were talking about Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot and how Abraham delivered Lot. There's one thing I want to mention before we go into chapter 20 that people make a mistake with this. Somewhere in the world, there will be a catastrophe, a big catastrophe, like an earthquake or a tsunami or something. And there are believers who tend to say that's judgment without even giving it any thought. But we have to remember that we lived in a cursed creation. And the Bible uses the word evil in two ways. One way it uses the word evil is the evil things that people do. That's our common use of the word. But another way that the word evil is used is catastrophe. So sometimes when you see the word evil in the Bible, it's just talking about a catastrophe. Now, we know that in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, their evil was judgment from God because we're told so in the Bible. But you've got to be very careful if a volcano erupts and people are killed or an earthquake or whatnot. Don't run to judgment. We, unfortunately, for some time, are living in a world which is prone to evil. And I'm talking now not about, well, it's prone to evil acts, but it's also prone to evil events. So we want to be careful about that. Okay, now, chapter 20, little introduction. This story records God's providential protection of his people, but its emphasis is on purity, specifically the preservation of Sarah's purity. Why is it so important for Sarah to be kept pure? The line of the seed. Otherwise it would be corrupted. For the fulfillment of the promise, marriage is important. Participation in God's promised blessing demands separation from worldly corruption. And Jesus, using different words, said that very well. You're either for me or against me. There's no such thing as somebody, if you say to someone, do you believe in Jesus? You can't say, well, I'm neutral on the subject. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. You're either for him or against him. And we've got to remember there are those who are for him publicly, as we're speaking, and against him privately. They have their own private life apart from God. They have to remember, that doesn't exist. It says in the Bible, all things are open and naked to him with whom we have to do. I remember when I was a young boy, every once in a while I would do something and say to myself, I got away with it, no one saw. But in the kingdom of God, it doesn't work that way. Every single word you speak, every thought you think, every act you commit is heard and seen by God. And there's a day coming when we're all going to be held accountable for that. Now, of course, if we're believers, our sins have been forgiven. But nonetheless, we've got to remember that God sees everything. Everything. He hears everything. Everything. And we as believers, our objective should be to glorify him in what we do and please him. Okay. First seven verses, God delivers Abraham from Egypt. Now, Abraham, this is after the whole story with Lot, remember? Remember how Sodom and Gomorrah were overthrown and Lot went up to Zoar? And that whole story, and his daughters committed incest with him, and we came to the conclusion you can take Sodom out of Lot, you can take Lot out of Sodom, but it's harder to get Sodom out of Lot. Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. So he settled in Gerar. Abraham said of Sarah his wife, she is my sister. So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream that night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man. That's not something you want God to say to you. You are a dead man because of the woman you have taken, for she is married. Now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, will you slay a nation even though blameless? Did not he himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hand, I have done this. Then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. Now, this shows us something very, very important. God's program and God's promises are extraordinarily important to him. And for her, for Sarah to have lain with Abimelech would have corrupted God's promise. And that he could not allow to happen. God's promises and God's program are more important than the machinations of man. As a matter of fact, if you think about Ananias and Sapphira and remember them, why was God so harsh to them? The reason was he had just begun a new phase of his program of redemption, and they were going to pollute it. And God could not have that. And so he took their lives. Okay. Earlier, God delivered Abram with a plague after he lied about Sarai being his sister. That was, remember back in chapter 12? Here, Abraham told the same lie about Sarah to Abimelech, king of Gerar, out of fear. Later, Isaac did the same thing with another Abimelech. Now, right away, that shows us two things. First of all, Abraham didn't learn the lesson that God had for him in the first place. But second of all, the iniquities of the fathers are passed on to the children, to the third and fourth generation. And so, Abraham did it twice, and then his son Isaac did it. And that's something for us to remember. You can have a family where you, your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather, all the way back as far as you can take your family tree, were all alcoholics. God visits the sin of the father onto the child of the third and fourth generation. Now, some people like to stop there, and that's not the real stopping point, because you have to finish what God's saying, but showing loving kindness and mercy to those who fear him. So that chain can be broken. That chain of sin can be broken. It can be broken by putting our faith in the Messiah and walking with him. But without him, we can do nothing. And so it's quite possible you may have something going on in your own life. I may have something going on in my own life. We don't understand how it got there in the first place, and it's a battle. We don't need to be detectives and start going through our family tree to find out who in the world, where did I get this from? The important thing for us to know is that if we love and fear him, that chain of sin can be broken. That chain of sin can be broken, and he wants it that way. And the other thing to remember that's important about that chain of sin is Jesus said, whoever commits sin becomes the slave of sin. You're wrapped up in the chains of sin. But he said, whoever keeps my word. Anybody know what he said about that? Everyone who commits sin becomes the slave of sin. But he said, if you keep his word, I'm going to paraphrase it, the chain can be... And well, they asked him, they said, we're not slaves to anybody. The Jewish leaders didn't think they were slaves. And he said, he who commits sin is the slave of sin. Sin enslaves. And it's quite powerful. On our own, we're powerless against sin. With him, the chain can be broken. Gerar was near the coast about... Well, before I go on with that, let me give you a vivid example. One of the most respected and admired presidents in the history of our country is John Kennedy, right? Now, John Kennedy was sexually impure. It's pretty well known now. People didn't know it while he was president, but he was what they call a philanderer. But lo and behold, his father was too. And so it's not surprising. Now, John F. Kennedy cannot say to God, I'm not responsible because my father was that way, because we are responsible for what we do. But he can say to God, help me to break the chains that I inherited from my father by fearing you and loving you, and God will do that. Gerar was near the coast about 12 miles south of Gaza and about 50 miles south of Hebron. That Vin should just be in the land of the Philistines. When Abimelech took Sarah, God warned him in a dream and by the barrenness of his wife and slave girls that she was married. What God did was he closed up all the wombs of the women in the kingdom and made all the men impotent. So essentially it was a dead civilization. There is a fitting wordplay here. Abraham had prayed that the righteous would not be destroyed with the wicked. Remember when he was bargaining with God about Sodom? Now Abimelech's words echoed the same concern. Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? The rebuke of this expression would have been forceful for Abraham. Because on the one hand, Abraham is arguing, not really arguing, but presenting an argument to God. And then you turn around and however many righteous men there needed to be theoretically in Gerar in order for God to save it, Abraham didn't qualify. If there were 9 righteous men and God said he wouldn't destroy it if there were 10, Abraham could not be counted the 10th man at that point in time. He was not living righteously. Okay? So when Abimelech assured God of his clear conscience in the matter, God told him to return Sarah and have Abram the prophet, that's the first use of the word prophet in the Bible, if we go back further, a prophet was originally called an oracle. And a prophecy was also called an oracle. But then they changed it. So when Abraham assured God of his clear conscience in the matter, God told him to return Sarah and have Abraham the prophet, Nabai, the first occurrence of this word in the Tanakh, the Old Testament. God's spokesman pray for Abimelech. Only the patriarch's prayer saved the king's life. God did not rebuke Abimelech, but he certainly gave him the sternest of warnings. He should not commit adultery because it was a capital offense. The wording clearly anticipates the coming of the law. Thou shalt not what? Commit adultery. And it appears as though even before the law, people knew that that was an immoral act, because these kings knew it. God made Abraham and Sarah one so that they might produce a godly seed. This was promised. This was basic to the covenant. See, the promised seed was to come through Sarah, but it was to come through Isaac and Sarah, not Abimelech and Sarah. And Abraham's rationalization is pretty weak because God had made a promise to him. And for Abraham to be afraid that Abimelech was going to do something to thwart God's plan showed a great lack of faith in this particular instance. Now, he was a great man of faith. We all have our lapses. But Abraham really could have and should have been honest about who Sarah was, and then it's God's responsibility to protect her and keep her pure, which he would have done. And it says in the Bible, the fear of man brings a snare. When we're afraid of somebody, that's a snare to us. I'm not saying we should live fearless lives. There are things to be afraid of. There's healthy fear. I'm afraid of fire. I think we all are. I wouldn't stick my hand in a fire. So on the one hand, fear can be a good thing because it can keep us from doing something harmful to ourselves. But on the other hand, we should not be afraid of man when man mocks us or derides us because we're doing God's work. We should not be have fear of persecution. Okay. The first incident in Genesis 12, however, was outside the promised land and reflected more clearly the life and death struggle of the nation in Egypt as God would later save them and deliver them. The second incident in chapter 12 was in the land and was an event in which God protected their marriage and thereby his promise. That promise was very important to God. God controls birth. He miraculously intervenes. He opens and closes wombs. No mere human potentate can thwart God's plan. And essentially, again, I believe what God did, when he said to Abimelech, "You're a dead man," he wasn't saying you're going to drop over dead. That phrase, "you're a dead man," could also be applied to an impotent man back then. And both Abraham and Sarah, in terms of childbearing, were dead. And what God did was he made all of the men of the city impotent, and all of the women, he closed up their wombs. What that means is that they could not bear children. And God informed Abimelech, "This is why I did it. And if you don't repent of what you've done, now that you know it's wrong, your civilization will end with this generation." And that would be it. And Abimelech was right. He didn't do anything wrong, but God had to protect the promise. That's why he gave him such a stern warning. Okay, verses 8 to 18. "So Abimelech arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, 'What have you done to us, and how have I sinned against you, that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done things that ought not to be done.' And Abimelech said to Abraham, 'What have you encountered that you have done this thing?' Abraham said, 'Because I thought surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife.'" Now see, that goes against the promise. That was a very bad lack of faith on the part of Abraham, because essentially what he's saying is God made a promise and he's not going to keep it. That's what it boils down to. "Besides, she actually," here's the rationalization. You know, human beings are expert rationalizers. "Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came about when God called me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, 'This is the kindness you will show me everywhere we go. Say of me, he is my brother.'" Abraham is more concerned about his own safety than about the promise that God had made. And he forgot that the promise that God made involved his safety. It necessitated his safety. Okay. Where was that? My thing ripped. Hate when that happens. When I was in high school, they all used to rip. And I had to get those little circular things. Then I stopped bothering. Papers flying all over the house. Okay. Excuse me? Is that where I stopped reading? Okay, thank you. Besides, she actually is my sister. Okay, read 12. And it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is the kindness which you will show me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. It's like the half-truth. A half-truth is a whole lie. Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please. To Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men you are cleared. In other words, the fact that she left with this gift from Abimelech was testimony that she was still pure. Abimelech would not give a mere concubine 1,000 pieces of silver. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids, so they bore children. So God took that curse off of them. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Okay. So, let me close this so I can put this through here. On page 87. Israelites and all believers should not destroy their marriage by adultery. You know, and I've seen this happen. There are men who commit adultery, and because their wife doesn't find out, they figure everything's okay. They figure they got away with it. I have two responses to that. The first one is, if a man commits adultery, the probability of his wife not finding out is close to zero. Women, they look, take one look in your eyes, they know. They do. The second thing is, it destroys the marriage. Saving a marriage from adultery is rare and difficult. And a man, if a man commits adultery and is truly remorseful at what he did, and does love his wife, and he slipped, whatever you want to say, he should not and cannot expect to regain her trust in a short period of time. It takes a, you can lose trust in an instant. It could take a few years to get it back again. So you got to be real careful, because think of what you're getting for what you're risking, especially if there's children involved. You know, the sin nature is very strong, but a man who commits adultery, what does he get? A half an hour of pleasure? And he's going to risk his wife and children for that? His children's lives? It's just not worth it, but the sin nature doesn't think that way. The wording clearly anticipates the command of the law. Thou shalt. Oh, no, I'm reading in the wrong place already again. Though God did not rebuke Abimelech, Abimelech did rebuke Abraham. The king spoke of the great guilt Abraham's action brought on him, and he spoke to Sarah of his offense against her. Abimelech sensed that his plan to take Sarah into his harem was wrong. So he made amends by giving the patriarch livestock, sheep and cattle, and slaves, allowing him to live on his land, and giving Abraham, whom he called Sarah's brother, he's still calling her his brother, her, his sister in a sense, 1,000 shekels of silver. It seems to me that Abimelech was doing everything he could to vindicate his integrity and have a clear slate with God. because you don't want God angry with you. God's preventing the destruction of Abraham's marriage by adultery reinforced the fact that the Israelites should not destroy their marriage by adultery. Remember, they'd been living 400 years in Egypt where there were pagans and temple prostitutes. And so when the generation of the Exodus came out and read this, they should have gotten the message, I've got to protect my marriage because look what's going to happen if I don't. So the message was clear. God did not want Israel to intermarry with pagans, especially when adultery and that of should be or divorce was involved. Israel seldom remembered this. As a matter of fact, what caused Israel's downfall? Israel was tremendously blessed of God during the reign of David and then during the reign of Solomon. But what actually brought down Israel's downfall? Adultery. David's adultery with Bathsheba. Adultery with Bathsheba. God said, when David committed adultery with Bathsheba, what he was going to do, but he said, I won't do it in your time or your son's time, but because of David's adultery with Bathsheba, we wound up with a divided kingdom led by ungodly kings and an ungodly people living in that kingdom. Well, because David wasn't where he was supposed to be when he was supposed to be there. He took a look. The flesh got the best of him. And look at the heart. If David could have given his right arm, he would have given it not to go back and not do that. I mean, look what it led to in his own life. His son, whom he loved, rebelling against him. Horrible. Who? Sarah? Sarah was, let's put it this way. Sarah was responsible for what she did, and she did not do the right thing. She should have said to Abraham as his helpmate, I cannot do that. It's deceptive. But the fact of the matter is, the blame goes on Abraham, because he's just like the blame goes on Adam. And also, the covenant promise was made with Abraham. He was responsible to see that the line was kept pure. Now, if you turn to Malachi 2. Right. Malachi 2, listen to this, starting from verse 10. Malachi 2, starting verse 10. Do we not all have one Father? Has not God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, each against his brother, so as to profane the covenant of our fathers? Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of the Lord, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. As for man who does this, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob everyone who awakes and answers, or who presents an offering to the Lord of hosts. Now, we can just read. Going to verse 16. For I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garments with wrong, says the Lord of hosts. So take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. You have wearied the Lord with your words, yet you say, how have we wearied him? In that you say, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them, or where is the God of justice? So here, God is using divorce metaphorically. And what he's saying is that Israel has divorced him and gone after other gods. And The result was pretty severe. God wouldn't hear their prayers. Their prayers and their sacrifices meant nothing to God at that point. So we have to be very careful as believers. We cannot, through our own actions, no matter how sinful, end our relationship with God. God will never leave us or forsake us. But if we fall into sin, our relationship with God can become muddled. It can, you know, because there's when we fall into a sin, on the list of priorities that I have for my life, that sin may be number 17. It's number one on God's list. That's the first thing he wants to deal with, because he wants our relationship with him to be pure. And there's a lot of people say, what's the big deal? Nobody's hurt. Marriage is a picture of the Godhead. And if somebody were to say to me, what's so bad about marriage? My answer is simple. What's so bad about marriage is God said it's so bad. And if he says it's bad, it's bad. And all the rationalization in the world can't change that. Okay, questions before we go into chapter 21? Okay, chapter 21, the birth of Isaac, verses 1 to 8. Then the Lord took note of Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. And the Hebrew word Isaac sounds a lot like the Hebrew word laughter. Okay, just... you'll see why that's significant in a moment. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, Abraham a covenant, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. That, I would say, was a miracle. Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Now this laughter can take on all different connotations in the language. There's a mocking type of laughter. Remember when Sarah was in the tent and she laughed, but it was a mocking type of laughter when the Lord said to Abraham, this was a laughter of joy. This was joyful laughter. Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Okay. To the notes, the birth of Isaac. God had Sarah give birth to the child of promise at the very time he had promised. Abraham and Sarah responded in faith by, number one, naming him Isaac. Number two, circumcising him according to the covenant. And number three, praising God for this amazing fulfillment. It was God who made this happen, not man. The name Isaac, which translates, he laughs, is cleverly explained in this passage. Sarah said that God gave her laughter, that is joy. Her laughter of unbelief was now changed to rejoicing through the provision of her son. Everyone who would hear about this, it should be, everyone who would hear about this would laugh. You got to put the word would in there. Everyone who would hear about this would laugh, that is, rejoice with her. Okay? Okay, verses 8 to 13. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Remember how Hagar was mocking Sarah because she had a child and Sarah didn't? Well, now watch what happens. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." The matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. He loved Ishmael as well. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you to do, listen to her. For through Isaac your descendants shall be named. And the son of the maid I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant." Okay, the expulsion of Ishmael in the notes. God used the incident of Ishmael mocking Isaac to drive out the child Ishmael and his mother Hagar, for they would be a threat to the promised seed. The word mocking is meshech, laughter or jesting, from which we get Isaac, Yishak. Earlier, Sarah had mistreated Hagar. Now Hagar's son was mistreating Sarah's son. The tables were turned. Earlier, pregnant Sarah caused Hagar to flee. Now she caused Hagar and her 16 or 17-year-old son to flee. Abraham was 86 years old when Ishmael was born, and that we get from 16:16. So, what, Ishmael would be a teenager. And 100 when Isaac was born, and Isaac was probably weaned at about 2 or 3. When Abraham became distressed because of Sarah's request to oust Hagar and Ishmael, God assured Abraham that Ishmael would have a future too, because he was Abraham's offspring. And God has said, "I will bless you." Two emphases then are these: the birth of Isaac, in which the naming commemorated the fulfillment of the circumcision confirmed, and the covenant. And the expulsion of Isaac is the removal of a threat. Once the promised child was received, Abraham and Sarah, rejoicing in God's miraculous provision, had to avoid any threat to Isaac's inheritance. Because God chose one son, his choice had to be protected. Abraham and Sarah had to expel Ishmael. Now notice what's interesting that's happening here. Who was born first, Ishmael or Isaac? Ishmael. Who was the firstborn? Isaac. So there's a reversal there. Yeah. Same thing kind of happens with Jacob and Esau. Okay. Let's take our first break now. Okay, next, verses 14 to 31. Verses 14 to 31. The angel of the Lord. Who's the angel of the Lord? Jesus. A pre-incarnate appearance of the angel of the Lord. Okay, verses 14 to 21. So Abram rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, and gave her the boy and sent her away. She departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water skin was used up, she left the boy under one of the bushes. Now, Abraham knew he hadn't given her enough, which meant what? That he was giving her to God. God would take care of her. She went and sat down opposite him, about a bow shot away, for she said, "Do not let me see the boy die." And she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. God heard the lad crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for the Lord has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation out of him." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with the water and gave the lad a drink. God was with the lad, and he grew and lived in the wilderness and became an archer. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Okay. Now, this is an interesting narrative, but what really makes it fascinating is what Paul does with it. In Paul's use of this story, who does Isaac represent? Let me give you a little help. Let me read this, and then after I read it, see if you can get it. Galatians 4. Okay, Galatians 4, and starting from verse 21. Ready? Tell me, do you want to be under law? Do you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman and one by the free woman. Who was the son by the bondwoman? Ishmael. And the son by the free woman was Isaac. But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son by the free woman through this promise. This is allegorically speaking. Paul's telling us, he's giving us a figure of speech here. For these women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now, this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother, for it is written, "Rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for more numerous are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. But at that time, he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit. So it is now also." But what does the scripture say? "Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of a bondwoman, but as a free woman." And so what Paul's doing there is he's taking Hagar and Sarah and Ishmael and Isaac and using them as a metaphor for the freedom we experience under grace versus the bondage we experience under the law. And he's telling us we should live under grace. We should be children of the free woman, not of the bond woman. Okay? Ishmael was born by the flesh through the slave woman. Isaac was born by the promise and was the heir. One represented bondage at Sinai, the other freedom when the promise fully came. And again, Isaac was the son of the promise. Ishmael was the son of the bondslave. When Messiah, the seed, came, the old was done away. Now that the promise has come, believers are co-heirs with the promised seed by adoption through God's grace. We're adopted into God's family. In a sense, unbelievers are children of Hagar, of the law. They're not free. Believers are adopted into God's family and are children of the free woman. They're children of promise. And all the promises of God apply to us now. To go back under the law would be to undo God's promise. And that's what was, everybody familiar with what was going on in Galatia at the time? In Galatia, they were telling Gentile believers they had to be circumcised. That was the big debate there. And Paul was saying, if you go and you get, Gentiles, get circumcised, you're throwing grace away and putting yourselves under the law, which you cannot keep. You're acting as though you're the bondwoman's child. And this, Galatians angered more than any other letter we wrote. You read Corinthians, it was pretty bad in Corinth when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, right? But he still had a certain formula he followed. He always sent a greeting and a commendation before he got into the doctrinal and behavioral issues. Galatians is the only letter that he begins without a commendation. And he even says, would that he were teaching you these things, mutilate himself. And in Hebrew, the word mutilate and circumcise are very similar. It's kind of a play on words. It just angered Paul so much because Paul was preaching a gospel of grace, and here these people were coming along polluting the churches, saying that Gentile believers had to be circumcised, which was against Paul's teaching. Just as Isaac and Ishmael were in conflict, so this flesh and the spirit do not harmonize. The flesh struggles against the spirit, often mocking it. Therefore, believers are to get rid of the slave woman and her son, that is, to remove the threat of the flesh and live by the Spirit. And so the question is, and I hear this asked all the time, somebody will walk up to me and say, are we under the law? Now, if somebody asks me that question, the first thing I have to do, and we should do, is, what law? Which law? There's a lot of laws. And then if they're specific and they say, are we under the law in the Bible? I once again have to say, which one? Because in the Old Covenant, there's a law called the Mosaic Law. In the New Covenant, there's a law that James calls the Law of Liberty, made up of all the instructions and commandments given in the New Covenant. And the fact of the matter is, we are not, in any sense of the word, under the Mosaic Law. We are not required to keep any of its statutes. We are, as believers, under the law of Christ, the law of liberty. Now, somebody says to me, well, if we're not under the law, does that mean we can go out and kill? No. But let me ask you a question. Suppose in California it's against the law to go through a red light, right? California. What if you're driving in France and you go through a red light? Are you under the law of California at that moment? No, you're not even there. Can you get a ticket for going through the red light? Yes, because France has the same law. Now, the law of Moses in the Ten Commandments says thou shalt not commit adultery. That doesn't mean that when we're no longer under the law, we're free to commit adultery, because Yeshua gives us even a stricter law to follow. You have heard that it said, you shall not commit adultery. I say to you, he who looks at a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already with her in his heart. So the entire moral law found in the law of Moses, not the ceremonial law, but the entire moral law found in the law of Moses can be reconstructed in the New Covenant, and it's a stricter law. Because both of those laws characterize the character of Christ. But believers today, like, for example, Paul says, to those who are under the law, I act as though I'm under the law, though not under the law myself. And what he's saying is, I don't want anybody to stumble over anything except the cross of Christ. So, in practical terms, if I invited somebody to my house for dinner, and I know that this person's an Orthodox Jewish person, I would cook them a kosher meal. Because why should I have some of them stumble over the food I serve them and then they're not going to be able to hear the gospel? Likewise, I personally don't eat pork, not because of any religious reasons. It's just not one of the things I eat. But if I went to someone's house who is, let's say, a Gentile or a Jew, doesn't matter, but let's say a Gentile, and they serve pork for dinner, I'd eat it. I like the flavor of it. I just, something I don't have in my normal diet. I'd eat it. Because why should I sit there and say, I can't eat that, and then there's no way they're going to hear the gospel? They'll be offended. So the key is what Paul said, we're free, but don't use your freedom to cause others to stumble. We're free. But we don't want to use our freedom in such a way that it causes those who are not believers to stumble over something less important, and everything is less important than the cross. Okay.
Mark?
Yeah.
So why did Paul had Timothy circumcised?
Right.
And was that as a cultural thing, so he wouldn't offend Jews, or was
Well, I think that Timothy, I'd have to check that out again. I think Timothy was half Jewish, wasn't he?
Yeah, his mother was Jewish as well.
Yeah, so just for appearance sake he did that. For the sake of the testimony. He wasn't doing it clearly, so you gotta be careful. If somebody sees what Paul did with Timothy and forms a doctrine around that, what they're doing is they're formulating their doctrine from narrative, which you don't want to do. That's like saying Abraham had more than one wife, so it's okay to have more than one wife. That's how the Mormons originally justify polygamy. When Paul had Timothy circumcised, it was so that that stumbling block would be removed. It wasn't, you know, being conciliatory.
So a Jew, a modern-day Jew, it would not be required to be circumcised.
No, modern-day
for salvation, but it's okay to get circumcised.
No, modern-day Jews are bound to be circumcised. We're required to by the Abrahamic Covenant. The Abrahamic Covenant is still in force.
And that's for identification with being a Jew.
Right. Right. The Abrahamic Covenant is still in force. It's an everlasting covenant, and so Jewish people should have their male children circumcised on the eighth day. That's something. Now, it also, it's contained in the law, but it predates the law. Okay, where was I? To go, page 91. To go back under the law would be to undo God's promise. Those adopted by the seed become seeds and are set free from the bondage of the law. Just as Ishmael and Isaac were in conflict, so the spirit and so the flesh and the spirit do not harmonize. The flesh struggles against the spirit, often mocking it. Therefore, believers are to get rid of the slave woman and her son, that is to remove the threat of the flesh and live by the spirit. We should be motivated by the spirit and not the letter. Okay, the covenant at Beersheba. Starting from verse 22. Now it came about at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me or my offspring or my posterity. According to the kindness that I have shown to you, you shall show to me and the land in which you have sojourned. Abraham said, I swear it. But Abraham complained to Abimelech because of the well water which the servants of Abimelech had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor did I hear of it until today. Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Then Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Abimelech said to Abraham, what do these 7 ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? He said, you shall take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand so that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well. Therefore they called that place Beersheba, because there the two of them took an oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, arose and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God, and Abram sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. The covenant at Beersheba. The striking feature about this passage is the explanation of the name of Beersheba, the home of Abraham. We'll get to that in a moment. This name will always reflect the covenant the patriarch made with the residents of the land, which enabled him to dwell there in peace and prosperity. The word Saba, to swear or take an oath, occurs 3 times in the passage. The numerical adjective Seba, that's 7, occurs 3 times as well. The name Beersheba, well of 7, or well of the oath, occurs 3 times. Certainly the stress is on the significance of the oath between Abraham and Abimelech, in fact, commemorated by Beersheba's naming. Saba is clearly the key to the passage. Later, Israel would learn about the solemnity of oaths and treaties. Just as an illustration how important oaths were, remember when God said to Joshua and Israel, go and destroy all the countries in this land, but don't go traveling hundreds of miles away, destroying every nation you see, just the nations that are in this land. So remember that those clever people who dressed themselves up in clothes as though they had been traveling hundreds and hundreds of miles and had no water in their skins and no food left, and they came up to Joshua and said, we're from somewhere real far away and we want to make peace with you and dwell in your land. And they were real suspicious, but they said, okay, and they entered into a covenant with these people of peace. Then they found that they had been lied to, but they still had to keep the covenant. Once you make a covenant, it was unbreakable. And it says in the psalm that a wise man swears to his own hurt. You have to be very careful when you give somebody your word or when you tell somebody you're doing something, because God holds that in high degree. If somebody says, will you, listen very carefully to what they're saying and consider carefully. And if it's something very important, or if it's something that's going to take a lot of effort or money or time or possibly cause trouble, give it some thought before you do it. Because once you do it, you're bound. That's the high regard covenants were held in these days. Okay, the story fits well in the context that builds up to the sacrifice of Isaac in chapter 22. The birth of Isaac was clearly promised, and in Abraham's deception, Abimelech learned that God's hand was on this man. Then the promised seed was born, and the rival was expelled. Now a covenant was made that allowed Abraham to settle in the land in peace and Abimelech to share his blessing. All this built slowly to the test in chapter 22, each chapter showing the completion of different phases of the promises. The story in verses 21:2-34 reveals that the patriarch was blessed by God, and that some pagans recognized God's blessing. That goes way back to when, remember when Israel came out of Egypt and the nations were scared of them? That goes way back to there. They were, the nations were actually afraid of Israel because they knew what had happened in Egypt. The motif of the well appears again in 21:19. God provided water, a symbol of blessing, out of the wilderness, out of barren land, out of a rock. Abimelech realized this, and after the controversy over a servant's seizure of the well, the two men made a treaty so the pagan king could share in the blessing. In making the treaty, how could he share in the blessing, by the way? How could Abimelech share in Abraham's blessing? I will bless those who bless you. And Abimelech had blessed Abraham greatly. So he became not a part of the covenant, but he entered into the blessings of the covenant. In making the treaty or covenant, Abraham gave Abimelech both sheep and cattle, including 7 ewe lambs. These secured Abraham's legal right to dwell in the land in peace and legally forced Abimelech to recognize that the well at Beersheba belonged to Abraham. The patriarch thus secured by treaty his right to the well, that is God's provision of blessing. And by the way, another reason Abraham paid for it, and we've seen this before, is because God had promised this land to him, so he didn't want any of it given to him by man. Remember that? The same thing we found with he wouldn't take anything Bera, king of Sodom, and he wouldn't take anything from the man who owned the cave that Sarah was buried in. He wanted what he would receive from God because he believed the promise God was going to give him this land forever. It is significant that Abraham planted a tree there and sojourned there many days, indicating his faith and security. To plant a tree in Beersheba presupposed a constant supply of water and indicated a determination to stay in that region. God would bless with well water, and Abraham would stay settled in the land. Dwelling under one's tree was a sign of peace and security. In Micah 4:4, and this was well known in those days, look what it says. Micah 4:4. This is talking about a time of peace that's to come in Israel's future. I'll start with verse 2. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. This is a description of the millennial kingdom. And he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords in the plowshare and their spears in the pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Now watch what it says. Each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree. That's metaphor for living peace. With no one to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. And it's interesting. Remember when in John, see, a man who was a free man would go out and sit under a tree and have a time of peace and meditation. And in John, let me turn to it, something interesting happens. What am I doing in Matthew? In John, it says this. This is John 1, starting from 43. The next day he purposed to go into Galilee,
and he found Philip, and Yeshua said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida of the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit." Now they had never met before. So Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel." Now, that's a very interesting response on the part of Philip, but undoubtedly, we're not told what Philip was doing under that fig tree. But it was custom in those days for a man to sit under his fig tree and pray and meditate on the word. So I wouldn't be surprised when we get to heaven if we ask Philip, "What were you doing under the fig tree?" He may have said, "God, Lord, reveal yourself to me." Something that caused him to respond that way when the Messiah said to him, "I saw you under the fig tree." It also is a testimony of Yeshua's omnipresence, because he wasn't really there in bodily form. Excuse me? 48. Right. Excuse me? You got to speak a little louder. It used to be. Used to be. Now it's the Star of David, but it used to be the fig tree. Yeah. Okay. The passage certainly anticipated Israel's future peaceful coexistence in the land with other tribes who would respond to the message of peace and desire to share in the blessing. A subtle rebuke, however, is found in the story, Abimelech's rebuke in 29 and 10. Abimelech pressed for the treaty so that Abraham would not deal falsely with him. All Abimelech knew of Abraham was that God blessed him, he was deceptive, and this tragic contradiction called for a binding treaty. So Abimelech was smart. He was watching out for himself, because even though he knew Abraham was deceptive, he knew he wouldn't break a covenant. Okay, verse 34, the Philistines. And Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. Okay, so that's just one verse, but a couple comments on it. The Philistines settled in Palestine en masse around 1200 BC. However, some sea traders settled on the coast of Palestine as early as Abraham and lived around 2166 to 1991 BC. Who would be representative of the Philistines today? Excuse me? No, the people, the Philistines. Who would represent them today?
Palestinians.
And they're doing the same thing with to Israel that the Philistines did back then. Okay. Okay, that's where we'll stop for today. Let me do this.